Right, Mr. Gilmore, before beginning, what is the correct pronunciation of your individual petitioner's name?
Seabell.
All right. I'll do my best then. Seabell.
Is it?
Okay. Okay, very well. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, we'll reserve 4 minutes.
Good morning. This is the reported court asking the first district court order requiring Mr. Seabell to disclose privileged communications pursuant to the crime fraud exception. We are asking for additional relief that flow from that decision, including reassignment to the state's company. This court has not previously published an opinion dealing with the crime fraud exception. Below, the parties worked from the two-step framework in the circuit. Before this court, we ask you to adopt and apply that standard, and in doing that, to decide the burden that must be met by the human party in order to invade the attorney privilege. We're dealing with a statutory exception to a statutory privilege, which falls to the question of law and facts. So it said, in this case, Mr. Seabell was accused of non-disclosure of immaterial facts that had absolutely no bearing on the action. Yet, the court found that his actions were enough to invade the attorney-client privilege. We believe the decision is not supported by the commission. Specifically, Mr. Seabell was accused of not disclosing information related to assignments of interests and entities that he had to a family trust. These entities were under contract with Caesars to share in food and beverage revenue generated from restaurants and various Caesars. According to Caesars, it didn't know and was never told that Mr. Seabell would continue to benefit from these restaurants following the assignment of his managers. Let's look, though, and see what Mr. Seabell told Caesars, if we know what Caesars did. In April of 2016, Mr. Seabell sent a series of letters to Caesars in writing indicating that he had created Seabell Family in 2016 Trust, one of those 14 pages,
27 pages. Counsel, before you go further on that, just briefly, I want to confirm that we agree that suitability matters from Caesar's perspective. So having a felon or somebody who has a felony makes a difference for them for a gaming license and those type of things. So that is a fact that goes to suitability.
Yes.
Okay. And was not disclosed timely.
And that's one of the issues in the case. The crime fraud motion, the impetus for that was non-disclosure of what's all the production.
Sure.
So to your point, his suitability and that disclosure goes to the issue in the case, if not the key issue, which is, was Caesars able to terminate his account? But that's not why they additionally sought to condone that.
Well, I think it's also a factual question. Was it disclosed or not? Yes, it's an issue in the case, but the question asked by Justice Stiglitz is, was it disclosed or not before the agreements were signed?
So the testimony is that he disclosed the investigation, not the guilty plea itself. So the April 2000 guilty plea is the point that he did not disclose. The testimony from him, confirmed by counsel who was present at the meeting when the communication took place, was the fact that the investigation was disclosed to senior vice president of the United. So, he notified Caesars in April of 2016, I created a family trust, and I named my wife as a beneficiary. Then in September of 2016, his lawyer communicates with Caesars and describes the mechanisms that had been put in place in his trust to deal with income flowing out of these restaurants. And in fact, sends the pertinent portions of the trust documents to Caesars, and may be found on the 7th of the appendix, starting page 15. So what did Caesars know? It knew that Mr. Seabell was looking to disassociate from these entities. It knew that Mr. Seabell was looking to assign his interest to these entities, create one trust. It knew that Mr. Seabell's wife, who he lived with, was going to be the beneficiary, alongside his grandmother, of that family trust. And finally, Caesars knew that the trust created a mechanism so that Caesars had some control over whether that money could be distributed to the beneficiaries. So what happened? In September 2016, Caesars terminated these contracts on finding that Mr. Sebel was unsuitable to meet his conviction. His counsel followed up and said, well, we've assigned these interests to the trust. Caesars said, the trust is not suitable. We've looked at the relationships. What you told us who the trustees are, which he also is, and who the beneficiaries are, your wife. We don't believe that's going to work in return. And that's what we're fighting about, right? But why are we here before this court today on the discovery issue? Because over the course of discovery, Caesars asked us to produce a prenuptial agreement between Mr. Sebel and Ms. Gorkman. And in it, it indicates what Ms. Gorkman will do with money that she receives out of the trust, whether it's as a result of income from these restaurants or otherwise, right? Caesars took that language and ran to court and said this was all false. This is a sham because in our mind, the prenuptial agreement is an end run of the trust and shows that you secretly intended to benefit all along from this trust assignment. A trust assignment that they rejected, just knowing who the beneficiaries of the trust were. The problem with that argument and where it falls apart is the prenuptial agreement didn't tell Caesars anything that it didn't already know. Mr. Sebel said, my wife is now going to be the recipient of this income stream that I used to be the recipient. Caesars knew that. That's undisputed. And in fact, when I took the deposition of the compliance officer who deals with suitability for Caesars, I said, was it an issue that the trust was the family trust that Mr. Sebel invented? She said yes.
What weight, if the court, obviously there's two positions. Your position, we've created these, he's hands off from these transactions. And there's Caesar's position, which is this is all just a conduit to, for him to continue to benefit from this relationship and putting us at risk. If the court credits the latter, so the court credits Caesar's factual position, where does that leave us in evaluating this?
I think it comes down to we have non-disclosure. We have non-disclosure of the material facts that don't influence action taken by. And so they are asking to find that the fraud was committed so that we can invade the attorney client. Right? One of the oldest, if not the oldest, privileges recognized in common law now follow. More has to be needed than non-disclosure.
Well, that takes us to one of the fundamental legal questions, which is why we're interested in oral argument. What should the burden of proof be at that stage?
I think the burden of proof is similar to what we may prove, not all the elements, but you need non-disclosure of material facts that influence the actions taken by the court. And we don't have any of those things here. Again, we know Caesar said, just based on the four corners of the trust and what you told us, this doesn't work. So knowing what happens to the money, right, further down the line, how does that change? And the concern that we raise is, this will open the floodgates to say, any fact that, hey, you didn't tell us about this transaction, we believe it's relevant, so now we get to know about your communication with counsel. I submit that goes way too far.
But in examining that argument, must Caesars establish that by a preponderance, or is it sufficient for them to be able to demonstrate that argument and support it with prima facie facts for purposes of in-camera review? So, that's the stage we're at, isn't it?
Well, we went through the second step, too. So we initially brought a petition after the first stage. So
yeah.
To your point, Mark, and it's a disputed issue in the briefs, we submit Caesar's soft what is called outright disclosure,
mm-hmm.
which is under the Ninth Circuit authority of preponderance of the evidence. So there is a lesser standard that if you dive into the authority, it actually looks like most parties often take, which is we don't think we can get that far. We just believe we can make a prima facie shot, which is more than speculation, but less than the comments.
Mm-hmm.
Submit the documents to the court in camera to see if we meet our burden, right? The prima facie showing may be less, but that's not the step that Caesars took. So they went to district court asking for outright disclosure of the documents. And so I believe on appeal, through this writ petition, that's the process that the court looks at to see if it was followed.
But the question there in follow-up to Justice Stiglitz's question is the district court determined that there was a preponderance of evidence to support that outright disclosure, correct?
That's correct. The district court came to that conclusion both initially based on the non-disclosure was submitted, and then we submitted the communications of the camera to the district court.
And isn't our standard of review abuse of discretion with respect to that factual determination?
I believe it's a de novo standard. Ninth Circuit has said, if, as the appellate court, you look at whether the evidence submitted was sufficient to meet the burden. And of course, the court has the benefit of looking at the in-camera documents if it believes it's necessary in reviewing what the district court did. Mm-hmm. I submit the district court shouldn't have got past the first step of the crime fraud analysis, which means if this court agrees, then you won't get that credit. You limit yourself to the evidence. And it really boils down to the nuptial agreement and the trust. And what I would say is, if you look at the trust act,
maybe I'm being overly simplistic, but isn't the argument being made here that through the prenuptial agreement and the undisclosed arrangements, a felon is able to access gaming or revenue generated from a gaming facility?
Yes, but you take it one step further, because fraud, of course, is that Caesars didn't, right? Because if you take the, if we take this crime fraud issue out of the equation, then that's what we're fighting, right? Should Mr. Seabell be allowed to continue to benefit directly or indirectly from his income? That's what this case is about. Mm-hmm. But we're here saying, no, it's worse than that. Caesars claims it's worse than that because he structured a prenuptial agreement to dupe us into thinking that the trust was a solution. But I would direct you to the Article 24 of the trust and the structure that was put in place that moots the prenuptial agreement completely. And why do I say it? Because the way the trust is written, it says if a gaming license decides that a beneficiary of the trust is unsuitable, trustees cannot distribute income to that beneficiary. So the power was put into Caesars' hands. The way this is structured, Caesars has all the power, and Mr. Seabell's counsel communicated that very fact to Caesars in real time. In September of 2016, he said, look at the trust. Without saying whether you'd be right or wrong, if you declare this Dorfman unsuitable, that's it. Then the money doesn't go anywhere. So if you think about it, Caesars can say, we'll accept the trust, but the beneficiaries are unsuitable. What happens? The money flows into the trust, but can't go anywhere, because the power is in Caesars' hands. So you look at that and you say, that's the way this document is trapped. Put the power in Caesars' hands. And not withheld from Caesars. Again, these provisions were sent to Caesars for review. And even then, the Lord put it very frankly in the email and said, if you designate his wife unsuitable, he'll never see this money, because she'll never see it. So then, why are we talking about the prenuptial agreement in the first place? It doesn't matter. So I go back to the argument here is being made that for this purpose, for the crime fraud exception, to invade Mr. Seabell's privilege to communicate with his lawyers, that he created a system, a mechanism to end run the trust. As Caesar says, we didn't know what would happen with the money after it got it, right? They knew it was his wife. There's no dispute. In fact, you don't see an affidavit from the motion to compel supporting this motion from Caesar saying, we had no idea. We had no idea. Instead, what we see is, told us who the trustees are, told us who the beneficiaries are. That's enough for us. Even though the trust has a mechanism that allows you to preclude his wife, and in fact, give the power to Caesars to decide who the beneficiaries are. So to the suitability point, until the trustees determine who is suitable to see that money, you won't go in. So we submit that the crime fraud exception, if you are going to go in and claim somebody's committed fraud, it's got to be material information. It's got to be something that you concealed, and thus the other side took action that they would not have already taken. We don't have that in this case. But I'd like to submit the rest of my time on this.
Okay, you have a minute. I'll give you an extra minute, 2 minutes on your rebuttal. You'll have an extra minute, Mr. Smith.
May it please the court, Jordan Smith on behalf of Caesars for all parties of interest. This court has not yet announced the proper test for practice to apply considering the private part exception to attorney-client privilege or NRS 49.21. Without this court's guidance, the district court and both parties below utilized the Ninth Circuit's framework for in re Napster. This court should adopt that test as well for two reasons. First, the Napster approach is consistent with the text of NRS 49.115. And second, the two-part approach of Napster and the allocation of its burdens sufficiently strikes the proper balance to protect the attorney-client privilege, foster full and frank conversations between a lawyer and a client, while at the same time providing a meaningful mechanism to prevent the privilege from being abused. Applying Napster, district court properly conducted an in-camera review, eventually determined by preponderance of the evidence that Mr. Siebel had used a sham family trust and secret prenuptial agreement, all crafted, structured, and participation with lawyers to try to defraud Caesars, a gaming licensee, into continuing to do business with an unsuitable individual who pled guilty for tax crimes. It's precisely this type of conduct that attorney-client privilege does not protect, and that the crime fraud exception is meant to expose. It's a little bit unusual in matters of first impression for both sides to be arguing for the exact same test. But here, in the court below and before this court, both parties urged this court to adopt the Napster standard. They disagreed, however, on a couple nuances and the application of that text. Napster, of course, says a two-part or two-step process, where at the first step, the moving party must establish by prima facie evidence that the client was engaged in or planning to engage in a criminal or fraudulent scheme in the advice that the lawyer was sought. If the moving can meet that low prima facie standard, then the district court may conduct an in-camera review to determine by a preponderance of the evidence whether the communications sought to be compelled were in furtherance of or sufficiently related to the crime or fraud. Here, Siebel argues that from the beginning, the district court should have applied the prima facie, the preponderance standard from the start instead of the prima facie standard. You heard it here today. According to Siebel, Caesars asked for outright disclosure from the start, and that simply is belied by the record. If the court looks at Caesars' motion at 1355 of the record, it's at the bottom of the page, to the top of the next page, Caesars asked for an in-camera review. At the hearing at 823 of the record, again, Caesars asked for an in-camera review. Also at the hearing, Judge Williams at 822 to 823 said he understood there had to be a two-part process following the Napster decision. That's exactly what ended up happening. According to the findings of fact from June of 2021, the district court found that Caesars had met its initial burden. That's at 977 paragraph 9.
Well, the district court actually applied preponderance to the initial burden as well, regardless of Napster's prima facie standard.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I agree that the order in hindsight is a little bit unclear from June 2021, but the judge's citation to Napster and also the reference in paragraph 9 at 977 to initial burden indicates he was applying the prima facie standard, particularly in the context of Caesars asking for an in-camera review and citing Napster. And that approach is even more clear if we compare the June order to the October order. In the October order, Judge Williams summarizes the proceedings and says he'd already determined Caesars had met its initial burden. Then there's a discussion about preponderance. Then in paragraph 10 of the October order, Judge Williams says Caesars has met its second burden. So citing Napster, there's a reference to initial burden. That is referring to prima facie evidence. And then there's a second reference to preponderance of the evidence, which is what Judge Williams applied after the in-camera review. So Caesars asked for an in-camera review. Judge Williams granted it after finding there was prima facie evidence to conduct an in-camera review, and then applied a preponderance afterwards. The second disagreement Caesars had with Siebel about the process is that Siebel argues, well, even if the district court applied the prima facie standard, the district court should have done an in-camera review before determining the prima facie standard. And the Ninth Circuit's case law does not require that. If the court looks at the 2016 decision, In Re Grand Jury Investigations, the Ninth Circuit adopted the Sixth Circuit's approach and said, at the prima facie stage, courts may conduct an in-camera review, but they're not required to, but they must conduct an in-camera review at the second step for preponderance phase. So Judge Williams was not required to conduct an in-camera review before determining the existence of prima facie evidence. There was sufficient independent, non-frivolous information before Judge Williams when he decided to conduct an in-camera review. And it's worth focusing a little bit more on what that threshold looks like at the prima facie stage. Different circuits have different formulations of it. Second Circuit refers to it, I think, as probable cause, which then it subsequently defines as reasonable basis. All of these different verbal formulations trace their way back to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Zola, where the Supreme Court said prima facie or an in-camera review in the crime fraud context is merely a factual basis adequate to support a good faith belief by a reasonable person that an in-camera review will show whether the crime fraud exception applies.
Do you think that that term or that phrase is something this court should adopt if it were to resolve this case by opinion? Or should we perhaps use a phrase that is similar to the requirement on a magistrate judge, for example, to determine sufficient facts for a bindover?
The court should adopt the Zolan phrasing of it. The magistrate opinion, I think, gets a little bit too close to the criminal context.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the cases do distinguish between civil and grand jury proceedings normally, but I think the U.S. Supreme Court's phrasing is the one to adopt. If you look at other phrasings and you really drill down to it, they all get back to this reasonable this concept. Good faith belief by a reasonable person. So even if they're phrased differently, they all seem to trace their way.
Do you think the prima facie test is sufficiently developed in our jurisprudence in other contexts where we don't end up conflating its usage here and how it's been used in other cases?
I do, Your Honor. And the closest analogy I've been able to think about is something like the personal jurisdiction context,
mm-hmm.
which also seems to follow a two-step process, prima facie at the motion stage, and then preponderance at trial. So I think there are analogies to make to the personal jurisdiction context that is prima facie and then preponderance. And so I do think our jurisprudence here is sufficiently developed to borrow from both concepts.
But at the heart of it, it's a reasonable basis to determine.
Good faith belief by a reasonable person is how I would phrase it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't use the phrase reasonable basis because, again, that kind of conflates the Second Circuit's probable cause standard, which I think is pretty far afield from what the U.S. Supreme Court was saying. I think the U.S. Supreme Court's Zolan phraseology is the way to go.
So in the first stage, if I understand petitioner's argument and counsel's argument here today, how does CSER address the provisions in the agreement relating to the existence of the trust and the provision in the trust that once you assess a person is unsuitable, there can be no distributions made to the wife or to anybody else for that matter? Wouldn't that be a factor to take into account when making the prima facie determination?
Yes, sir. I think the trust and the prenuptial agreement, which CSER didn't know about, I think those documents on their face are prima facie evidence. Circumstances aside, those two documents are prima facie evidence of an attempt to defraud CSER to continue to do business with somebody that's unsuitable. It's true as far as it goes that Article 24 of the trust contained facial, superficial restrictions on distributions to unsuitable people. It says at 2733 of the record that no distribution should be made from the trust from a restricted business defined as a business doing business with a gaming licensee. But CSER didn't know about the side agreement in the prenuptial agreement, which required the beneficiary of the trust, Mr. Siebel's wife, to contractually then deposit any distribution from the trust into a joint bank account. So the way this was structured was essentially to give a facade, an appearance that Mr. Siebel was disassociated while laundering money from businesses operating with CSER through the trust and through the prenuptial agreement. And this structure and practical effect of it was confirmed by CSER's unrebutted trust expert. Judge Williams noted that CSER had a trust expert that was unrebutted. His report is in the record at 3212. And Mr. Bruce Stone confirmed, the trust expert said, that given the nature of the prenuptial agreement, the restrictions in the trust were illusory. That's what CSER's expert said. It was also confirmed by CSER's gaming expert, Mr. Scott Shearer, who said on paper, yes, the trust did own these business interests on paper, but the prenuptial agreement defines them still as Siebel's separate property and allows him to essentially force his wife to take any distribution from them and put them in a joint account, even though he's unsuitable. And this idea that, well, the deposits were never made or never happened, time fraud purposes, it's simply immaterial. Same with the arguments about, well, Caesars already knew this, but Caesars didn't do anything different. The time fraud exception applies equally to attempts to defraud. It applies to unsuccessful attempts to defraud. The way I think about it is the time fraud exception applies to good liars and bad liars. Simply because you didn't succeed in duping someone with using legal services doesn't mean you're protected by the attorney-client privilege. The crime fraud exception exposes attempts to use the privilege or abuses of the privilege. So if something is unsuccessful or doesn't actually work or you didn't succeed in tricking your victim with your lawyer's help, that still gets exposed, that is still not covered by the attorney-client privilege. And to say that Caesars already knew we were under investigation, I think the court should look closely at what the testimony actually is here at, I think it's Mr. Frederick's testimony attached to the reply brief, where he says, Mr. Siebel never told me he was under investigation. He told me his mother was under investigation. And I believe that's at 32-37 of the record, but it is attached to the reply brief below what Mr. Frederick's actually said. So Caesars didn't know when Mr. Siebel was under investigation going back to 2014. Never once did he disclose it. And up until the April 8th, 2016 letter, a mere 10 days before he pled guilty, suddenly he's sending a letter saying, I'm now creating new entities, I'm transferring them to a trust, and appointing two managers. And by the way, nobody else but my wife's going to be a beneficiary. We know from the structure of the documents that's simply not true. It was, again, done in furtherance of an effort to defraud Caesars. All of this evidence we've been talking about and describing is more than enough to satisfy a prima facie standard for the district court to conduct an in-camera review in the first place.
Did Caesars ever contend that the wife was unsuitable?
No, Your Honor. So the argument is, well, under the trust, Caesars could have deemed the wife unsuitable and prevented all this. Caesars still has an obligation to act in good faith. So unless there's a reason to believe the wife is unsuitable, Caesars wouldn't just declare it out of, you know, just to try and keep Mr. Siebel away. So there has to be an obligation of good faith. And it's also
so was that part of Frederick's assessment, that it was an illusory provision?
It's Bruce Stone.
Oh, excuse me, Stone's assessment.
Bruce Stone's assessment in his report, he analyzed it in 13-12, that yes, facially there were restrictions in the trust, but when you look at the prenuptial agreement, Mr. Siebel still retained the right to have those profits, if you will, deposited into his bank account. So this was confirmed by Mr. Stone. And again, unrebutted, and Judge Williams gave way for that. A brief word on the standard of review. The standard of review here is abuse of discretion. I understand what Napster said. Napster said that Napster acknowledges a certain split. It says it's a mixed question of law and fact, so we review this de novo. But the rest of the sentence is also telling. Review de novo unless the scope of the privilege is clear, or if the fact or if the court's assessment is essentially factual. Given the fact we're at a stage where there's been an in-camera review and the district court has determined that these documents were furtherance of a fraud, the court's review here is essentially factual, so an abuse of discretion standard would apply. Just like this court did in Cannarelli 1, the writ proceeding about the fiduciary exception to the attorney-client privilege, this court applied a de novo review about whether that exception existed, but then after conducting its own in-camera review, it applied abuse of discretion as the appropriate standard. That would be this court's framework here, too. Judge Williams has conducted an in-camera review, so when checking his work, this court would apply an abuse of discretion standard. A brief word on the second step of the crime fraud exception test from Napster. I don't have a whole lot to add on the in-camera review aspect. I'm the only one in the courtroom who actually hasn't seen the documents. Of course, Mr. Siebel has, this court has, but I only have the three that were cited in the minute order. And it's clear from just those three examples that they were certainly used in furtherance of and sufficiently related to a crime, particularly the first one that Judge Williams highlights, saying this could hurt if Caesars really analyzed it. If these documents were really created for legitimate estate planning purposes, why would it hurt if Caesars really analyzed it? It would only hurt if you're trying to slip something past Caesars and give Caesars the impression you're disassociated when you're actually not disassociated.
And counsel, do you agree that Judge Williams can look at these as a group as opposed to parsing each particular email?
I do, Your Honor. I think it'd be asking district court judges to do too much. You have to make specific findings about every document in in-camera review. Here we had about 200, which isn't a small amount. We're all aware of in-camera reviews that have thousands. You'd be asking a district court judge too much to be doing them one by one. this court in Cannarelli one to the group approach. I think we have to leave it to district courts to determine how best to do it. But I certainly don't read Judge Williams' orders as saying he just looked at these three and then said, oh, the rest are not privileged. He says four examples. So I think the three listed in the minute order are best considered to be exemplars of documents. It's clear that Judge Williams took a thorough approach. Briefly on the reassignment request, I don't think there's any basis in the record to reassign Judge Williams here. It's not as if he's ever expressed an ultimate opinion on the merits. Judge Williams simply made the findings that are required under Napster, and he didn't make those findings by clear and convincing evidence to be the ultimate standard at trial. It was simply by a preponderance. And if the court looks at Judge Williams' comments, it's clear he took this situation very seriously. He said multiple times, I've got to be very careful. The attorney-client privilege isn't something to set aside heavily. So with that, Your Honors, I'd ask the petition be denied.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Mr. Gilmore?
If you look through the record, the words prima facie never make their way into the motion to compel, reply, or the order that was drafted by Caesar's counsel that was signed by the district court. Right? So if you look at what normally happens, as I mentioned, a party might say, I don't know if I have enough. I think I've made a prima facie showing. The district court conducts an in-camera review to see if you get all the way there. Right? That's step one. Step two, of course, is then to go through and identify what documents are related to and in furtherance of this crime. And the point of that is, in the Ninth Circuit has said, you don't just release everything, because you have to make sure if you're going to invade the privilege, you focus on the subject. Here, the district court got through step one before that in-camera review took place. There's no disputing that. The first order that arises out of this motion, the district court said, the burden's been met, now I'm going to do the in-camera review for step two. So here, we're operating under a preponderance.
But didn't, and I'll go back to the same question I asked Mr. Schmidt, didn't the district court apply preponderance of the evidence in that in-camera order?
Yes, as to step two. So the way the order is written, as step two now, he's looked at the emails, and in his opinion, all of them relate to...
No, I'm referring to the order that requested the documents be provided to the court for in-camera review.
Yes, and that's so the initial order, if I understand your question,
yeah.
He cites the preponderance standard. And then he says Caesar's has met his burden. In fact, as we submitted in the petition, you could read his order to say, I've already found that all the emails are in furtherance of the crime. Before he'd even seen them, and that we submitted in and of itself was there. Because the Ninth Circuit has said, you have to look at the emails before you can get that. So in fact, the way the order is written, and that's what we work on, he already decided preponderance before he even looked. On the Napster case, I would ask the court actually, not only does that set the framework, but if you look at the facts there, very similar. We have a main loan document that said one thing, and then a side deal that supposedly added additional information. The Ninth Circuit said, we can see from the loan document what's going on. The side deal doesn't add to it. So I believe that case would support the relief we see. We ask for the petition.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gilmore. Mr. Smith, thanks for your arguments and your briefing. The case will stand submitted and the court will be in recess.